Your first eight guys maybe should be blue plate specials, but those back five guys, they should be more like tin hats, more guys that are grunt players, garbage players that dive for the ball.
You are listening to the Scrambled Eggs Podcast on CrackSidewalks.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome into Scrambled Eggs, your unofficial Marquette basketball podcast. Joe McCann and Phil Bush here with you. Phil, we got a lot to talk to today. It seems like for the second consecutive week, the game we really are excited to talk about was the early one, and the one after that kind of soured it a little bit. But still, overall, I am happy with a 1-1 week for Marquette. How about you?
I am satisfied with it. It turns out you prognosticated correctly. You predicted a Seton Hall win and Butler loss. I went the other direction, but you know what? 1-1 is just fine. We're kind of sitting in a good spot right now, so I'm happy.
Yeah, Marquette is in pretty good shape, and we're going to, a little bit later in the podcast, maybe talk about that path to 10 wins that maybe we've talked about a couple times here on the podcast, and also take a closer look at Sam Hauser and the kind of season he's having. I feel like he gets overlooked a little bit, and you know, Marquette has some guards that are absolutely tearing it up this year, but we're going to take a closer look at Sam Hauser in a little bit. But first, let's talk about these two most recent wins, Phil. Why don't we start with the good? Let's start with the game against Seton Hall, which I think really had all of Marquette Twitter really buzzing earlier this week. That game to me is the picture of what Marquette could be at its absolute peak this season, as far as having a typical offensive game for them and having a way above average defensive performance. That showing against Seton Hall is about as good as this Marquette team is going to look.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those good news, bad news, right? Because that was unlike the Villanova win last year, which the Villanova win was epic, right? But it seemed to come out of nowhere. That, with the exception of maybe a couple of minutes in the start of the second half against Seton Hall, that was a wire-to-wire Marquette dominated. They looked good doing it. And like you said, they owned both ends of the court, which is not something we're accustomed to by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, they played like a top 50 defense against Seton Hall, unlike their typical 150 ranked defense. So I don't know what Wojo put in their Wheaties, but it would be great if they could capture that more consistently.
Double order for the rest of the season.
Yeah, because it was, Delgado got his double-double, but it was, I guess, as double-doubles go, it was a quiet one for him. And Seton Hall never really felt comfortable offensively, it seemed. And I mean, quite frankly, their most potent offense was Sanogo, who hit two threes, which tripled his 3-point production as for his career or for the season to this uh-huh. point. And that's one of those things where you go, well, if he's going to make those, like, all right, whatever. The energy was high, the effort was there. It was probably both the best played and the best coached game out of Marquette I've seen this season.
Yeah, Seton Hall did not shoot the ball particularly well, particularly not from three. That's their strength, but you know, the teams actually shot the same percentage from the floor. Both shot 44% from the floor, but it just felt like Seton Hall shot the ball so much worse than when Marquette had that edge on three pointers. That's kind of when Marquette hardly turned the ball over, and while Seton Hall had 12 in the game, that's kind of where the advantage shifted. But yeah, that was just a no doubt beating of a team that was, at the time, the first place team in the Big East. They were the last team to lose. They came into that game 3-0, and they just got it handed to them. The game was essentially a pick'em game in Vegas. KenPom had it as a 1-point spread for Seton Hall. So, as far as calling it a quote-unquote upset, that may be a stretch of the truth, but it still was a significant win for Marquette to just dominate Seton Hall like that. Like, winning wasn't a total shock to those who had, looked at the numbers, but it certainly was not an expected win. It's certainly not expected to win by that much, that convincingly. Seton Hall, like I said, they were just all out of sorts. Marquette played very well inside. They rebounded very well in that game. And really just took away everything that Seton Hall was good at, like second chance points, points in the paint was not typically what Seton Hall would expect. that they Marquette just played a complete game, and I think just that rotation of seems like one of the two guards is going to go off almost every night, whether it's going to be Rousey or Howard. It happened to be Rousey on that night. He had his big night. He had 31 points. And not that Howard was bad. I mean, he had 12 points. It was an efficient night for him, 5 of 11, hitting a couple of threes, had 12 points. But, you know, that was the night when Rousey carried the offense for the most part, and everyone else just kind of chipped in. And you continue to get significant, if not maybe a little quiet efforts from guys like Greg Elliott, Sakar Anum, and Jamal Kane defensively. And so you just got a little bit from everybody. The defense played, like you said, Phil, I think the best defensive effort of the season by far, considering the opponent. And that is now the bar for me as far as what a great effort by this Marquette team is.
Yeah, you really wonder, like, what was some of that, like, did Seton Hall not play as well as they could, or did Marquette's defense just play that well? And if they played that well, what prevents them from playing that well? You know, we'll talk about the Butler game and the defense. Whatever they fixed in the Seton Hall game, they went and broke all over again in the Butler game. So it just makes you wonder why are they capable? You know, I'd feel a lot better if I didn't think they were capable of that kind of performance. But now that I know that they're capable,
right?
To a certain extent, it could be a little disheartening.
Yeah, and you know, maybe some of it was Seton Hall just didn't shoot the ball well, but I felt like a lot of that was because of Marquette's defense. I thought they forced Seton Hall into uncomfortable shots, and they challenged guys down low. Like, Seton Hall didn't get a whole lot of easy layups or easy dunks, and those are teams, like, that's what Butler did on Friday night. I mean, Butler got a lot of easy buckets, and they just prevented that. So, like, while Seton Hall's shooting percentage was down, I do think it was in part because of some altered shots by the Marquette defense. And yeah, like, you do kind of walk away from it, Phil, kind of like you said, like, all right, can we do that every night? Because if we could do that every night, I mean, that would be like certainly be a top 100 defense. And then if you pair a top 10 offense with a top 100 defense, then I think you're an interesting team heading into March. Like, not like a Final Four team or anything, but I think you're at least interesting as somebody, maybe a team that few people might pick to win a couple games.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Like you mentioned earlier, that basically it's seemingly settled into Rousey or Howard. One of the two of them is going to kind of carry the offense, and the other is going to not go away, but they'll have a little quieter of a game.
More of a supporting role.
Yeah, more of a supporting role. And what it really seems to be is that, you know, Wojo seems to have settled into okay, let's find the hot guard, whether it's Rousey or Howard. Maximize their minutes, and then minimize the minute. Well, minimize isn't the right word, but basically be willing to bring Elliott and to a certain extent Kane in off the bench and kind of play that two guard in more of that stopper role. Because one of the things that is nice, and it's not Kane as much, but Elliott is starting to shape up offensively. He's not
really
just a defensive stopper. And you saw that in the Seton Hall game. He had a season high, what was it, 13 points? So right, if he can pair offense with his already pretty good defense, especially for a freshman, I think his minutes go up.
He had 9 points against Seton Hall. But, yeah, your point's taken. But, yeah, he is starting to emerge. You see that confidence growing with him. He's no longer just defensive role player off the bench. He is – I mean, he's Marquette's top reserve guard, I would say. Like, he is the number one guard coming off the bench for this team right now. And, yeah, he had 13 against Villanova was the game you were thinking of. But,
yeah,
the confidence is certainly there. He can attack the basket every now and then. He's shooting the ball fairly well. I mean, he's shooting 35% from three in limited attempts, only 17 attempts. But he is – I mean, he does have that confidence to hit three-point shot. He had a big three in the Butler game that gave Marquette its biggest lead of that game when it was like a 7-point game. But, yeah, like, Greg Elliott has far exceeded any expectation I had for him. I mean, I thought he would just be a guy who would be buried on the bench this year. It might be kind of a project for the future. But that was, you know, when we had Hanif Cheatham on this team, I just didn't see how much of a role Elliott would have. But, I mean, he has almost kind of made people forget Hanif Cheatham was on this team, quite frankly, because
right,
I think he is doing a lot of things people hoped Hanif Cheatham would do. And yeah, he has just stepped into that role, and it looks like he's kind of carved out a spot for himself on this team for the next few years, for sure, because he can play defense, and as long as that shot continues to come around and that confidence on the offensive end, because he's got the size that Howard and Rousey don't, that maybe could allow him to attack the basket a little more and maybe try to get fouled. And even though he's not, at this point, a great free throw shooter necessarily, but he adds things to that backcourt that some of the other guards don't have. So, yeah, I have been nothing but impressed with the way Elliott has contributed and started to flourish once we've gotten to Big East play.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, and we'll talk about it maybe a little bit more during the Butler game, but I am a little bit surprised. I would have thought Kane had he was Big East Freshman of the Week. He had a couple of big games. It was 2 weeks ago in the opening the conference play against Georgetown and Xavier. But his minutes haven't spiked as equally. You know, Elliott's really seemingly kind of taken the reins in terms of the first player off the bench and the primary freshman. So it's interesting to see. I'm hoping Kane can get some more minutes down the road, but quite frankly, some of that may be because Sam Hauser is blocking him because they're maximizing Sam Hauser's minutes, which is probably appropriate.
Yeah, and I think Sakar is just a guy that Wojo trusts just a little bit more at the three spot, especially defensively, I think. And I think he just kind of gets Kane minutes where he can there.
Yeah.
Then the emergence of Elliott, too, because you're playing a lot of lineups with Elliott at the three and playing still Rousey and Howard together. Because, you know, it's – I know sometimes during crunch time it has been maybe only one of them out there, or maybe when one of them's on is in foul trouble. But, I mean, the most frequent lineups over the last few games, like four of the top five most frequently used lineups for Marquette per KenPom have both Rousey and Howard in it. And then Elliott is in like three of those at the three spot. And then he's at the shooting guard for the other. So I think the fact that Elliott is really emerging, and then I think Wojo trusts Sakar just a little bit more, I think he's just trying to find spots for Kane. And maybe Jamal's just going to have to look at it as like, you know, just got to maximize my minutes when he gets the call. And if he gets a few open looks, you know, Wojo will, as he has shown, ride the hot hand. If Kane gets a few open looks, can knock down a couple shots, then that might be a night where Wojo says, all right, why don't we just maybe back off Sakar or back off Elliott for a little bit and see how many points Jamal can get tonight.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. So it's kind of Elliott can, since he can play kind of the 1-2, there's not, you know, especially with Hanif not there, there's more room for Elliott than there is for Kane. So we'll see how that adapts with time, because, you know, I think there's definitely you've got more offensive potential with Kane than you do with Sakar, but Sakar is definitely probably probably doesn't make any sense, but is in my opinion is the number one defensive player on the roster for Wojo. When he needs to stop a guard, it's Sakar that he puts out there.
I definitely probably agree with you. Although Greg Elliott is making a case, though.
Yeah, oh, as he should, right? And I mean, after some of the work he did on Jalen Brunson, and yeah, you're not going to stop Jalen Brunson, but he certainly harassed him some, and the work he did on Cartwright for Providence. I mean, Elliott's definitely making a case for that kind of lead, the what I would term the Jimmy Butler guard defender role. Right now, it is Sakar, I think, but Elliott is trying to take that role from him.
And they're welcome to share that role, by the way. We don't need just one guy playing good defense.
We should probably have at least three, four, maybe five. Who knows? Let's get crazy. Yeah.
And that's what we got against Seton Hall. Not so much against Butler, though, as we alluded to a minute ago. You know, the maybe defense definitely came back to the mean a little bit. Keelan Martin pretty much did anything he wanted in that game. What do you think went wrong in the Butler game, Phil? Because the first half was pretty much all Butler, and then Marquette made a really nice run in the second half, got up at 7, I think, after Elliott hit that 3 and Butler called a timeout. But, man, then the wheels really came off after that, and then Martin just went off, and it just seems like Marquette couldn't get any stops.
Yeah, well, the wheels came off in a hurry. I have not seen a 7-point lead disappear that fast in quite some time. It was something like 74 seconds of game time, just a series of turnovers and bad shots. What went wrong is, quite frankly, that was one. If Seton Hall was probably the best coach game we've seen all season, I really wonder if the Butler game wasn't. I don't want to say it was the worst coach game because I didn't think it was that bad, but I question the game plan and the lack of adjustment during the game. I mean, when they started to pick and roll and put Martin on Elliott, or get Elliott on Martin, and when Butler was on the offense, you know, poor Elliott. I mean, Elliott looks really tall, but he's still only 6'3", and Martin's got a couple of inches on him and a couple of years of experience, and he was just kind of getting lit up. I would have liked to have seen, you know, Marquette make more adjustments, get Sakar in more, get Kane in more, and trying to defend that pick and roll that way, because it was really a question of they just couldn't get stops in the last 10 minutes. And I just really questioned the inability for the coaching staff to adjust.
You know, one thing that kind of jumped out to me, at least in the first half, Phil, was it seemed like and Wojo kind of talked about this after the Villanova game and maybe after the Seton Hall game too, is that he wanted to get to the free throw line more, and you know, the free throw disparity between Marquette and its opponents. And I think Marquette was trying to drive to the basket a little too much in the first half. You know, Rousey definitely had a few, and he wasn't getting calls. And look, I see the value in trying to get the free throws even or close to even, and especially because you want to get your opponents' best players in foul trouble. You want to get those easy points from the free throw line, especially when you're one of the best free throw shooting teams in the Big East or in the country. But Rousey kept, it's at least in the first half, it seemed like he kept driving to the basket and just getting his stuff just rejected and swatted into the third row. And I just don't see that. I think you're kind of chasing a stat that doesn't matter that much. Because I think if it's not working, especially if the little guys are driving to the basket and getting rejected and you're just trying to throw it up against the trees, I think you're taking away your opportunities to shoot more three-pointers, because I think that's an area where a team like Marquette can make up for the fact that they're not a team that can drive to the basket and get fouled a lot because they're such a jump-shooting team. Yeah, you're not going to get a bunch of points from the free-throw line, but you can make up for that by upping your effective field goal percentage by hitting more threes. And I don't think he was just Rousey going rogue either. I think he was kind of under orders to go to the basket. Otherwise, I think Wojo would have pulled him out after a few of those drives where he just kind of barreled into the trees and threw up something hoping for a foul. And I think Wojo, I think at least the team maybe realized, all right, look, we're not getting these fouls. Maybe we shouldn't try to go into the trees as much. But I do question the idea that, all right, well, we got to try to get to the free throw line more. Yes, there is some value in doing it, but if it's not a strength of your team and it takes away from one of your strengths, and that is three-point shooting, I'm not sure how much that helped Marquette in that first half.
So you're saying Wojo ordered the code red?
He ordered the go to the free throw line at all costs is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think that's something he said after he was either Villanova or Seton Hall game, talking about the free throw disparity between Marquette and its opponents, and that they needed to do something about that. And yeah, it would be nice to go to the free throw line more, but I think you're hurting yourself if you're just, like I said, if the plan is just Rousey going into the trees and trying to make something happen, because that is just not a strength of his.
No, I agree. Well, and it's interesting because you've seen late in games, especially Marcus Howard, and we saw it in the Butler game, certainly, the outside shooting opens the lane by the end of the game. I mean, there were a couple of drives Howard had there late in the Butler game that, you know, the defense just gave it to him. And, you know, whether you make a bucket or you get fouled or not, I mean, quite frankly, we're a jump shooting team. It's highly unlikely we're going to foul any players out, especially any important players. So, I mean, points are points, whether they come at the free throw line or they come at the layup or they come from a three-point shot. I don't think we need to worry about free throw disparity or it's kind of, I kind of feel like that's really that's on the same level as like rebounding margin. You know, it's you get the rebounds within the flow of your offense and your defense. The margin compared to how the other team rebounded is not really a thing. I don't think free right. throw margin is a thing either. Like I said, I just didn't think they made adjustments. It, you know, I think the announcers generally, and I know I'm kind of crapping on one of your Kansas City Royal announcer guy.
I know, Fizziak, man. He was calling the game for us. I enjoyed hearing his voice. But, yeah, go ahead.
But I was just going to say, like, I kind of thought they were kind of crappy all along. But it was but one of the guys mentioned something about the Butler coach, about LeVar Jordan being – actually being stubborn, which was a good thing because he kept doing the same thing over and over again because it was working. And that was my frustration, but kind of the inverse of that, like, Wojo, do something. They're doing the same things over and over again. We're not stopping it. You know,
yeah, one of them said a couple times, if I were Wojo, I think I'd go into a zone. I'm like, man, you do not know Wojo.
Yeah, that is like, not a thing.
He does not like going into his own. They've tried it a few times. I don't remember if they tried it very much at all against Butler. But I think he said multiple times that second half, if I were Wojo, I think I'd try going into his own. I'm like, man, Wojo does not want to go into his own. It's just not his thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you really think a zone at this point, especially if you've got Rousey and Marcus in, like, say, the 2-3, I don't know that it's going to be appreciably that different. I mean, because if you can't put ball pressure at the top of the key – you know, because everyone can see over top of Rousey and Marcus, people are going to get the ball in the lane and distribute from there. I don't think a 2-3 zone when you've got both of our Smurf guards in, I don't think it's going to make a difference.
No, I don't think it's going to solve the problems, but, I don't know, maybe I know Wojo tried that 1-3-1. One time, yeah, with Froehling, and it looked like a total mess. Maybe there is some type of zone that they could put in, but yeah, I'm not sure a 2-3 is what's going to work out. But, you know, Wojo loves a man-to-man defense, and, you know, I think they made some strides with it against Seton Hall. But then again, it just kind of all went to hell against Butler. So, not against trying new things, but yeah, I'm with you. Especially when the coach really doesn't believe in his own defense to begin with. I think trying to force it when I'm not sure that you got the personnel up top for a 2-3 is probably going to help at all. So yeah, I'm kind of with you there.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's interesting. It does make you wonder what the difference between Seton Hall and Butler was. It seemed like Butler was just better prepared for Marquette than Marquette was for Butler.
Keelan Martin was a big difference.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, if somebody like Carrington had played like that or against Marquette, yeah, that probably would have swung the game the other way. But yeah, I think when one of your opponent's best wing players goes for 37 points, that's certainly a big difference. And yeah, Marquette could do absolutely nothing to stop him. Yeah. And but yeah, like like I said, the thing really unraveled pretty quickly. And not like this was like the reason they lost, but it seemed like when you had that 4-point swing, when kind of Froehling lost the ball or, you know, missed that one layup, and then they went the other end for a dunk. Like I think when Marquette was up 4 at that time,
yeah,
that dunk got it to within 2. Then I think Butler never looked back after that. I thought that was a big momentum shift in the game, and maybe that affected Marquette mentally, defensively, and they just lost a lot of confidence there, and Butler did nothing but gain confidence from there on out. And as that thing just kind of spiraled out of control, Marquette could do nothing to stop it. They couldn't hit any outside shots really to kind of silence the crowd after that. I mean, Hauser had an incredible game. We'll talk about him in just a minute, but other than that, you know, it was relatively kind of a quiet or frustrating day for the offense, outside of Hauser.
Yeah, it was just a tough game, and one of the things, the last kind of thing I'll pick on, and again, because I'm not a highly paid coach like Wojo is, but the constant switching of the five spot, like it I don't know. I get there's some strategy to it, and I understand that, but it just never seemed to work. When you had Matt Helt out on the perimeter and Marcus Howard, you know, being posted up by a 6'10" guy, it just didn't feel right. So I wonder if we don't see a totally different strategy when Butler comes to town in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it seems like teams do have the kind of that book on Marquette. When Marquette's big guy, whoever he is, hedges out too far, you know, make a cut to the basket or look for your own big man because he's probably going to be open or going to get matched up, or he's going to have like Rousey or Howard on him, and it should be an easy two. But yeah, I think teams have definitely picked up on that, on that Marquette maybe gambles a little bit too much with their big guy defensively.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. But I mean, we weren't by the end of the game, we weren't really in that Butler game, but there was plenty of points. I mean, even up until the last couple of minutes, that Marquette certainly, you know, if they got a couple of stops, they could have caught up, or, you know, not given up 7 points in 74 seconds to lose the 7 point lead. So it's not like all hope is lost, and like you said, 1-1 is what we wanted out of the week. So, you know, it would have been really, really nice to get that win, but I guess I'm not ultimately devastated by it.
Yeah. I mean, like I would call the Butler loss is a bummer, but it's not a bad loss. If you're talking tournament resume and things like that, it was a road game. Marquette was not favored to win. I think Butler was a 4-point favorite in that game. Butler's a good team, a tournament team. Yeah, you would have loved to have it, 'cause then you'd be in great shape to get to double digit wins in the conference. But, you know, you get over it and you move on to the next one. But before you talk about the next one, I do want to talk about Sam Hauser's performance and really season overall. 'Cause, you know, I think we've done plenty of praise for Howard on this podcast. We've had plenty of praise for Rousey on this podcast. You know, we've been down on Rousey at times, but Rousey has been incredible. And I think when he's been good, we've been more than fair talking about what a great season he's having. But Hauser quietly continues to have just a marvelous season. You know, at the time we're recording this podcast on Saturday afternoon, early evening, Sam Hauser ranks 7th in the country in offensive rating. I mean, he's shooting the ball incredibly well. I mean, shooting almost 50% from downtown. And paint touches threw it out there this week, and it sounded a little blasphemous when you first tweeted, but when you look at the stats, really not that crazy that Sam Hauser could be a second coming, if not a better version of Steve Novak. And you look at the numbers, they're pretty comparable, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly a more dynamic version of Steve Novak. And by that, I mean, he can generate his offense in different ways than Steve did. And quite frankly, he's a better defender than Steve. I mean, I think Sam Hauser is probably our best interior. He's certainly our best inside out defender, but he's probably our best interior defender as well. So he's, I don't know, what's your takeaway? Where do you stand?
Well, I would say, first of all, I'd say, like, without doing much research, Sam Hauser's got to be one of the best pick and pop players in the country, considering the guys he's got around him, that whenever it's either Howard or Rousey with the ball, I mean, there's not a more dangerous weapon in the country as far as a guy who's big and physical enough to come out and set a screen, and then can just step out and hit that three, and those guys find him all the time, and he's shot 111 threes this year, and he's knocked down 55 of them for 49.5%. I mean, that's tops on the team. That's 28th in the country at the time we're recording this podcast. And but yeah, you like say, you know, look at the stats of Hauser as a sophomore this year and Novak as a sophomore. Offensive rating, 135.9 for Sam, 120.6 for Novak. So advantage Sam there. Sam with a higher effective field goal percentage, 65.7 to Novak's 56. 2-point percentage, Hauser much higher, 52% to 34 for Novak. 3-point percentage, close but slight edge to Sam, 49.5 to 43. And then the rebounding numbers wouldn't surprise. And actually, the rebounding numbers are closer than I would think. Offensive rebounding percentage, 5.5 for Sam, 4.4 for Novak, 15.9 defensive rebound percentage for Sam, 14 for Novak. So, sophomore year comps, pretty close, but the edge in every stat is towards Sam, and who knows what Sam's going to turn into over the next couple years here as he continues to blossom at Marquette and have a starring role. His game is really complete, and not to say that he's necessarily hit his ceiling as a player, but I agree with you, Phil, that he is one of Marquette's best he probably is Marquette's best all-around players. Probably doesn't get enough credit for what a good defender he is. I think he might be Marquette's best defender in the post, because I think he's very smart down there. He doesn't commit any silly fouls down there, where as maybe guys like John or certainly John is more physical, but, Held is just a bigger dude, but they get kind of caught in bad situations, maybe get a few more fouls on them. Sam really doesn't foul, get called for many fouls in the post when he's defending, and he just does such an outstanding job that, Sam is quietly having just a terrific season.
Well, some of us maybe in the preseason prediction pool may have predicted that Sam Hauser would be the team's MVP, and while you look at eye-popping numbers from Rousey and Marcus, Sam's probably the most, not to heap yet more praise on him, but he's the most consistent player, right? I mean, he doesn't always get, a bajillion points, but I'd have to go back and look. But I think he's consistently, double digits, somewhere between 12 and 22 points. He did have a game where he scored 31, I think. He's the most consistent player. He's also the player that was, for a while there, was getting the most minutes. So I think it all reflects the import of Sam Hauser on this team.
Yeah, as far as traditional stats, he's averaging 14.9 and points and 5.8 rebounds. So essentially 15-6 he's averaging, which is very good numbers, but nothing that's going to make somebody say, wow, those are just amazing numbers. But you're right, he is so consistent. You can always count him to probably score in double digits when, the guards are looking for somebody to dump the ball off to, looking for a screen. Sam is always there, and they can always have that option to go around that screen and kick it to Sam. And he's always going to have a green light if he's got a good look from three. And the way he's shooting this year, he should have a green light, because he is just shooting at an electric clip right now. And hopefully he can keep that up and he can just continue to excel. You know, that offensive rating stat, I was kind of looking at it on KenPom, and it's one of those stats that I don't know how it's calculated. And I even looked on KenPom how they explain their stats. If you're not really familiar with them, it kind of explains what they all mean. And next to the explanation for offensive rating, it says, it's very complex, but it's very accurate. If you want to know more, buy this book. So you essentially have to take a college course to understand it. So I kind of look at it like war in baseball. I have no idea how that's calculated, but I know it's good to have a good one. So all I know is Sam Hauser has a terrific offensive rating. Again, as we're recording this on Saturday early evening, he's top 10 in the country. He's number 7 in the country in offensive rating. So
that's good,
Hauser,
right?
that is – do you know what's better, though? Being number 1. Do you know who's number 1?
I'm gonna.
Yes, you do. You know – yeah, you know, it's Matt Helt.
Oh, it's that's Matt, right. Matt Helt.
You talk about a guy we don't talk about enough on this podcast. Now, I say this partly tongue-in-cheek, but seriously, as we're recording this on Saturday, Matt Helt is the number one player in the country in offensive efficiency. Now, that's with a bit of an asterisk, because he doesn't have enough possessions used or minutes played to qualify as truly the nation's leader. But if you're including all players regardless of minutes, he is number one in the country. It's a pinch hitter in baseball, leading the league in batting average. Yeah, he doesn't have enough at-bats to qualify for leading the league. But if you're looking at who has the best numbers, it actually is Matt Helt. So I think we were long overdue to do something that really praises the fact that Matt Helt is the number one most efficient player in the country.
He does his homework while doing wind sprints. He gets through airport security faster than those with TSA PreCheck. He can run an entire Jimmy John's by himself. He can tie both shoes at the same time. He is Matt Helt,
the most efficient player in the country. He doesn't always get the ball, but when he does, he usually scores. Keep shooting, Tres Amigos.
That's kind of amazing. I hope it goes viral.
I really do too. Sometimes my creative juices get flowing, and I just kind of get rolling with that.
I've never gotten more excited texts from you than when you sent that link.
Yeah, I said, all right, so like Phil, I like sent that to Phil. I'm like, Phil, please look at that. Phil, have you looked at it yet? Phil, I sent you something. But yeah, so I say this, you know, kind of with like holding my breath a little because I'm just afraid Jalen Brunson is going to go off Saturday night against St. John's and ruin it. Because as we're recording this, Jalen Brunson, which is kind of amazing because his number of possessions used is way higher than Sam's, yet he has an offensive rating similar or to Matt's, I should say. Yet he has an offensive rating very close to Matt of like 140. So I'm afraid that by the time you guys all listen to this, that Matt technically won't be the number one most efficient player. But I do think it is kind of funny, honestly, because you know, you look at how did Matt get this number? Well, when you think about it, anytime he does actually touch the ball, he's probably going to get a layup or a dunk because you know one of the guards kind of dumped it off to him, or maybe Matt gets an offensive rebound and puts it back. So it's net like the offense is never going to be in a situation. It's like, oh, we got to feed Matt health. We got to get into health and have him get buckets. So most of the shots he takes are pretty easy and pretty makeable. Like for example, he's actually top 70 in the country in 2-point percentage. So that's best on the team. But I don't want to give Matt a little dap because number one is number one, no matter what kind of, you know, asterisks or like funny stats go into it. He is the number one most efficient player in the country. So I wanted to give him a little shout out here on the show.
Well, and you know, you still have to hit the easy shots. I mean, just ask Theo John about how easy some of the layups are down in the post.
Right.
You know, so Matt makes them when he gets them.
The point is, Matt has a role on this team. He's not a star. The team doesn't need him to be a star. He has a role, and I think he serves it very well. It seems like Froehling is starting to take away a few of his minutes. I think the Big East play is maybe a little too fast for Harry Froehling right now. I think Harry's really going to flourish over the next year or two. We may not see his full impact until next year. But I think as he's kind of starting to get a few more minutes, I think he is a little wide-eyed at times, and you know, that 3-point shot isn't exactly where I think he would want it right now. But, I thought the game was too fast for Theo John back in November, but I think he's kind of caught up, and I think he's kind of playing at a more mature pace, I think, when he gets the ball. He's not rushing shots, and doesn't seem as lost out there. But, you know, when Matt Held's out there, he plays his role. He serves his role, and I think the fact that he has the number one offensive rating in the country, regardless of number of possessions used, speaks to how well Matt Helt plays his role. So, hey, good for Matt.
Yeah.
And free Matt Helt, for crying out loud. Free Matt Helt.
My God, unleash the number one most efficient player in the country, for God's sake.
Let the milkman eat. Come on.
Somewhere Eric Gebby is just going ballistic.
Yeah, that's our going away present for Eric of Marquette Nation. He's heading to Washington, D.C. this week, but I trust he'll continue to listen to the podcast. But, you know, as we look ahead to the rest of the week, Phil, you know, one game coming up on Monday, then a nice break for Marquette before a very tough stretch against Xavier and Villanova, but they can't afford to look ahead to that because the tricky game against DePaul is coming up on Monday.
The Fighting Dave Leto's coming into Milwaukee.
Yeah, and DePaul only exists for the fact that so people can say things like, please don't lose to DePaul, or oh my gosh, we lost to DePaul, or oh crap, we're playing DePaul. That is what DePaul's existence in the Big East is. And Marquette has had plenty of nightmare games against DePaul, most of them on the road, but they've had a few nightmares at home. Most notably, I guess the last time Marquette lost at home to DePaul was Henry Ellenson's season, and that was kind of a season ender, that loss.
Yeah, that was like, the garbage to lose the game at the end of
the
game.
Yeah, there was no coming back from that. Now, I will say, like, while a loss to DePaul on Monday would be crushing for Marquette's tournament hopes, it's not like a season-ending kind of thing because there are enough games on the back half that I think you could maybe limit that damage. But for the most part, this is just a game you just have to win. You're a 10-point favorite. You're at home. You're playing a team that's probably going to finish 9th or 10th in the Big East. I know DePaul is better. I will give that to DePaul. They are better than they have been the past couple years. The Division II transfer they got, Max Strus, he's helped. He can certainly play, although he can be a little out of control sometimes. But by no stretch of the imagination is losing to this DePaul team okay, at home or on the road, but especially at home. Marquette just has to take care of business on Monday, and then they can, then they have a nice break, a 9-game stretch when they can kind of gear up for the, that crucial 2-game stretch. Kind of what are your feelings heading into Monday against DePaul?
Well, to be honest, I would think, you know, I think the team's going to be a little hurt after that Butler performance. You know, if Marquette had gone out and beaten Butler, I think I might have been a little more worried about this game, because they would have been, you know, especially being such a young team, very puffed up. Oh, it's just DePaul. Yeah, we just beat Butler and Seton Hall. We got a long break coming. Let's just cruise and get this done. I think the Butler loss refocuses them a little bit. You know, and I haven't seen anything from DePaul. I mean, any team in the Big East is capable of putting in a tough performance, but I don't see anything from DePaul other than the name on the jersey that scares me, given the past history. Like,
yeah,
the,
just
the,
like,
team itself,
past
I'm not
nightmares
afraid of.
And traumatic experiences keep right. coming back every time you play DePaul, because it's like one of those games where you go into, like, nothing really good can happen. Like,
right.
like if you beat them, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. But if you lose, it's a catastrophe. Again, Marquette conceivably could recover from this, but I would rather not try to find out. I would rather just beat down DePaul like you're supposed to, and then just continue to take care of business. Few numbers to run by you. The thing that's most encouraging for me is DePaul has a very poor 3-point percentage as an offense and as a defense. So they don't make a lot of threes, but they also give up a lot of threes. So I think both of those things are things to be encouraged about from Marquette's side. Marquette should be able to get some good looks from three. Hopefully you knock those down at home, as you should, and then hopefully you can maybe build a big lead and just pull away and just blow DePaul out at home. That would be my hope. They do get a lot of buckets inside. They're almost top 50 in the country, a 2-point percentage. So that has also been kind of a problem for Marquette. They give up a lot of easy buckets inside. They're one of the worst in the country. They're ranked 318 in Kenpo, in defensive 3-point percentage. Actually, you know what? I had that backwards. My bad. DePaul is actually very good defending the 2-point shot. DePaul is actually not great getting 2-point buckets. They're 207th in the country. So, my bad. Had that backwards. So, one area where DePaul is apparently pretty good is defending the 2-point shot. So, maybe driving to the basket would not be a great idea in this game.
Well, this is where we really don't need to worry about free throw disparity. It's not a thing.
Right.
Yeah. It's again, by every statistical measure, there is nothing that says Marquette should struggle in this game, right? Like, Marquette should dominate DePaul in this game. But it's DePaul, right? Now, now, having said that, Marquette dominated DePaul pretty good last year at home. So, you know, if you get a repeat performance from them in that regard, then we're okay. But the bottom line is, whether it's ugly, whether it's a blowout for Marquette, whatever, as long as they get the W, that's all that matters. I'm not going to read too much into this game, simply because playing DePaul every time is a horror show.
Right, exactly. You basically watch the game holding your breath, saying, I just hope a terrible version of Marquette does not show up, right? You know, just like sometimes you kind of like in past DePaul disasters, you kind of like feel it coming, right? Like all of a sudden the shots start falling. Maybe you've like gone 5 or 6 minutes without making a field goal. Like, all right, here it is. Here it comes. Great. It's the bad version of us that shows up against DePaul. But yeah, like I said, you look at DePaul statistically, as you would expect from a team that is outside the top 100 in KenPom, there's no real stat for DePaul that jumps out and say, oh, wow, that's something to really be concerned about, because they're kind of middle of the road at best in almost every statistical category. You know, maybe they don't turn it over a ton. Maybe they do their top 100 in forcing turnovers. I mean, I guess that's something maybe you could look at, but there's nothing like their top 50 in or top 20 in that you can say, all right, well, that's a way that DePaul could really beat Marquette. Like, the way DePaul would beat Marquette is if somebody like Max Strus just goes off, which Max Strus just looks like a guy who could just ruin my day and like and just go off for 40 points just out of nowhere. I think he was like a Division II All-American.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
He's capable of going off and scoring a bunch of points, but he's not shooting at a particular – he's a decent three-point shooter. He's shooting about 36%. So he's not a guy you want to leave open, that's for sure, but he's also not a guy who can shoot on the level of any of Marquette's shooters, top shooters like Howard or Rousey or Hauser. So, yeah, I mean, Strus is the guy that I would be concerned about as far as potentially going off. And I guess Eli Kane is also a guy you got to keep an eye on. I mean, he's one of their top guys as far as significant contributors on KenPom. But, yeah, I mean, man for man, I'm just scanning their roster, and I chuckle because there's a name on here that I almost forgot plays for them. Austin Grandstaff, do you recognize this name? Because
yeah.
I do, because he played high school ball here in Texas. Believe it or not, he was an All-American coming out of Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Really?
He wasn't a McDonald's All-American. He was a Jordan Brand All-American. I remember at the time, just because he was also a DFW kid, we compared him to Marshall Henderson. Just a guy who just would just shoot, and just make a ton of threes. And at the time, I called Austin Grandstaff a more team-oriented guy version of Marshall Henderson, because at least he did get other guys involved. But the idea when you saw Austin Grandstaff playing high school is just he was just going to shoot all day and just make a ton of threes. Not exactly doing it so much at DePaul, though. He's only 6-26 on the year, so I guess he's just not getting a ton of playing time. But I just was looking at DePaul's roster, and I just chuckled when I saw the name. Like, oh, Austin Grandstaff, I forgot he was a thing.
Yeah, still a thing. But, you know, the one other thing I will say about this game against DePaul is it will officially be something hinky is going on if Marquette's free throw defense does not improve after this DePaul game, because DePaul is the ninth worst team at free throw percentage in the Big East. And if somehow they're at like 71.9%, if somehow DePaul shoots better free throws than they typically do, I'm officially concerned that someone in free throw land doesn't like us, because it's getting to be a real problem.
Yeah, hey, man, even in that Seton Hall game, Seton Hall shot above its average. It was 8 for 10.
Yeah.
80%.
And Delgado went like something like 4 for 5 or something like that. It's nuts. I don't understand.
Just one of those dumb stats that you really can't do anything about.
Right.
You know, that's the way it is. But, you know, Phil, I thought, you know, before we got out of here, I did want to kind of wrap up with some thoughts as far as Marquette's path to possibly getting 10 wins in the Big East. You know, before we kind of got into Big East play, I kind of looked at the path as you sweep Georgetown, DePaul, so that's 4 wins right there. You beat St. John's, Providence, Creighton, and Butler at home, so that would be 4 more, so that gets you 8. You get a road win against one of those 4, so that's 9, and then you steal one from the top 3, the 6 chances you get against Seton Hall, Xavier, and Villanova. Well, you know, kind of checking the progress report there, they're 1-for-1 against the bottom 2. They haven't played any of those middle 4 at home yet, so that's to be determined. They got that road win because they went and defeated Providence, so there's that. You can check that off. And then they already stole one from the top 3. They beat Seton Hall at home, so there's another check mark.
Yeah,
and the thing is, as we kind of move forward a little bit, I'm almost tempted to move St. John's into the teams you should probably sweep, just because I'm not sure kind of where they're going right now. They play Villanova on Saturday night, so I don't think that would go too well for them. But
is it official that Lovett is off the team?
It's official that he's not going to play again this year.
Okay, that's what I meant.
Yeah, he's injured, and I think his dad said, "Yeah, we're shutting him down for the year." And St. John's kind of like, "Oh, all right." like that release didn't come from St. John's. So the fact that they're going to be without Lovett for the rest of the season, unless there's some kind of change of heart, kind of changes my perspective on St. John's. I almost kind of feel bad saying I called it, because before Big East play said, I said St. John's is that team that always says they're going to break through but never really does, and like now it's kind of going that way, but kind of because they lost one of their best players, and even Pons missed a couple of games too for them, so injuries have kind of hit St. John's a little hard, but that's kind of part of the game, and they are what they are, and right now they are a team that is kind of hanging around with Georgetown, DePaul in the Big East basement. So I kind of look at St. John's as a team you should probably sweep as well.
Well, they haven't won a Big East game yet, right? So
So as the season goes along, that could potentially become a bad loss if you lose to St. John's. So I don't think going to New York now and losing to them would be a loss you you could say, well, that's fine. It would be a bad loss probably.
Yeah.
So I would kind of look at it as you pile up 6 wins against St. John's, DePaul, and Georgetown, and then you just got to get 4 the rest of the way. And you've already gotten 1 by beating Providence, and you already got another by beating
Seton Hall.
So, like, it almost kind of becomes like getting 10 wins is almost, I wouldn't say an expectation, but I think it's very realistic for Marquette, just because I think you can get 6 against kind of the bottom of the league there, and then you just got to find 2 more somewhere else because you've already gotten 2. And you're going to have the toughest part of your schedule behind you once you hit the halfway point, because you would have already played Xavier and Villanova twice. So I think getting to 10 wins is a little, like, I think I was maybe being optimistic saying Marquette could get to 10 wins when Big East play began, but anything can happen, especially because Marquette plays so many road games in February. So, but I am getting cautiously optimistic that Marquette could reach that 10 win mark, and if they do that, I would feel comfortable saying that they're going to be in the tournament.
Yeah, I really think, looking at it, like 10-8, you're right, is the expectation. I think 11-7 is in play as a thing, right? I mean, if Marquette can play at a high level, 11-7 isn't unrealistic.
Yeah,
it's going to be a challenge.
You mentioned that, but you look at the KenPom projection. Like there are two ways to read the KenPom projections. Is the official projection at the projected record at the bottom at 9-9? That's what they have. But there's also, if you go game by game, it's actually different. And let's say for those not familiar with KenPom, why is it different? Like the projected record kind of recognizes that some of these 50-50 games go either way, so that some of the projections could shift and maybe be wrong. But if you go game by game, it actually has Marquette at 11 wins.
Yep.
So, like, it has Marquette finishing very strong, winning 5 out of their last 6. Granted, a lot of those are on the road, but against teams that Marquette should be able to beat, like St. John's, like DePaul, like Georgetown. So, yeah, like, you're kind of like me hesitant to say 11 wins is something Marquette can do, but Marquette, 11 wins is something Marquette can do. It actually can, especially if St. John's is going to be down in the basement with Georgetown and DePaul, then, you just got to find a way to get another win somewhere else against one of these middle teams like Butler or Providence, try to get one against Creighton. And then, 11 wins, it may sound, well, you're getting a little crazy there. No, not really. Like, again, go game by game on KenPom as of Saturday evening. It has Marquette at 11 wins. Granted, let's see, what are the ones that are 50-50? Creighton at home is 50-50. Marquette's only 1-point favorite there. What would be the other one that's really close?
St. John's away, 55%.
And DePaul away is at 61%. So that one's also relatively close. So, yeah, those are the ones they kind of have that are kind of toss-ups. And Butler at home is just a 3-point spread. So, yeah, there are some there that could go either way. But, again, if you go by those projections, it has Marquette at 11 Big East wins. So it's attainable. And I'll say 11 wins, Marquette is in. Like, that is a no doubt for me. Marquette is in the tournament with 11 wins.
Well, 10 wins, I think they're in. Like, I think they hit 10. I don't know how you keep them out.
Yeah, I would kind of lean that way. For what it's worth, latest bracketology projections, I think, kind of had them as in the last 4 byes. So the teams that are in but don't have to go to Dayton. I think that's kind of where some, like, on CBS, I know Lunardi had them there. I think it was like a 10 seed was his latest projection for Marquette. So
playing in South Carolina against South Carolina? Great.
Actually, funny, it was a very intriguing matchup from Lunardi. It was a 7-10 game against Notre Dame.
I would love that.
With a potential second-round matchup against Oklahoma and Trae Young.
I would not like that.
I would enjoy watching it. I don't know if I would enjoy playing Trae Young. I mean, let me put it this way. If Marquette played Oklahoma in the tournament, all the stat heads who follow college basketball would be all over that game, saying you have got to tune in and watch Trae Young shoot it out with Rousey and Howard. Like, I think everyone would be buzzing about that game, maybe fully saying that Oklahoma would probably roll over Marquette, but just to say, you just got to see Marquette try to beat Oklahoma and watch Howard and Rousey shoot. But that one did jump out to me as far as the bracketology projections for this week. But hey, long way to go, but I'd say, again, knock on wood right now, I'm looking pretty good for Marquette, especially just get past this DePaul game, put my mind at ease, and then we can have a full week to kind of prepare mentally And then the team can prepare, of course, for Xavier Villanova back-to-back, which is going to be very, very challenging. But I think if you beat, as long as you beat DePaul, you're kind of playing with house money in those two games. And because if you steal one of those, then you're in great shape heading to the back half of the Big East schedule.
Well, in that week, you're really – that's another week where we just want to go 1-1, right? I mean, if you beat DePaul and then you've got Xavier Nova and you take one of those two, Xavier on the road or Villanova at the home, either way, like at that point, I mean, you're talking top four finish in the Big East potentially.
Oh yeah, like I mean, I would say you take 1-1 in different, in like in a realm like that would be a dream 1-1. Whereas, opposed to the past 2 weeks, like you're saying, you have to get 1-1 if you still
right,
want to
exactly.
talk about being
yep.
in the tournament mix. But yeah, I'm just hoping for 1-2 over the next three, with that one being DePaul, and then again you're playing with house money after that. So
what do, are you,
for now,
are you projecting a win against DePaul?
Yes, for God's sakes, yes, for my sanity and the sanity of all of us on Marquette Twitter, Marquette social media sphere, and everyone on MU Scoop, God bless them. Yes, I am projecting. I'm going to say a comfortable win against DePaul. I'm going to say hopefully they make it a no doubter and like win by 12 points.
Yeah, I actually think it's going to be bigger than that. I think it's going to be like 20 points. It's going to be like the Seton Hall game. I think it's going to be a wire to wire. Marquette's just in control. I think that Butler game will reset them appropriately.
Yeah, you bring that defense that you brought against Seton Hall. I mean, it's going to be a no-doubter. I mean, Marquette would have the walk-ons in at the end if they can play that kind of defense against DePaul that they played against Seton Hall. Absolutely. So, hey, before we get out of here, Phil, I did want to wrap up with one more kind of, I don't know if it's a funny thing, but just a thing I wanted to bring up. I'm going to call it Marquette and the NBA, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I don't know if you saw this week. The good, Dwight Bikes, now had his two-way contract with the Pistons upgraded to a full NBA contract. So something I learned over the past few weeks is that these two-way contracts, you can only spend X amount of games in the NBA, and then you have to spend the rest in the G League. So when you hit that max, the team has to either upgrade you or cut you, or just send you back to the G League for the rest of the season.
And when they upgrade you, that means guaranteed money, right? That's the catch, right?
Yes, I think that's the kicker. So good for Dwight Bikes. He's got a full contract with the Pistons now. So great. Like, I keep singing the praises of Dwight Bikes. I mean, has any player improved more beyond what their expectations were coming out of Marquette than Dwight Bikes has? I mean, he was a role player at Marquette, and he has turned into a very nice professional player. He spent some time in Europe, spent some time in China, I believe. He's played overseas a bunch. Now he's had a few cups of coffee in the NBA. Now he's got another deal with the Pistons. I am just proud of Dwight Bikes and what he's become as a pro. I mean, he has worked his butt off, and good for him.
Well, I guess shocked because he's playing a different role and a different style than he really did at Marquette. Like, he just transformed his game. It's impressive as hell the amount of effort he clearly had to put into his craft to get where
he is.
It's
not necessarily a knock on him, but just the fact that he's played more NBA games than guys like Jarrell McNeil or Dominic James, guys that we thought are Darius Johnson Odom, guys
Lazar Hayward.
Lazar Hayward, guys that we thought would have nice NBA careers, or maybe at least get a cup of coffee in the NBA, and they really haven't. I mean, Lazar was a first-round pick, and he hung around for a couple years in the league. But yeah, overall point, who's had a better NBA career? Dwight Bikes has probably had a better NBA career than Lazar, so good for Dwight. Now, as far as good, bad, and the ugly, the bad, Vander Blue was cut by the Lakers, so he was on a two-way contract as well, but he had hardly seen the floor, hadn't played much, so he's a free agent. I hope he finds another team, but I think it's probably about time for Vander Blue to maybe go make some money overseas. I may be too late to do that this year, but I think that's kind of where his future lies, as he's kind of getting a little older and fewer NBA teams are interested in giving him a spot. And then the ugly, did you see this thing with Jamil Wilson this week?
Didn't he get signed by the Clippers? Did I miss something more than
boy.
That?
Oh, boy, did you miss something?
Yeah.
So the Clippers, like what I was talking about with Bikes, he was at almost his max number of games played with the Clippers on a two-way contract, so they cut him. And he was about to get picked up by the Lakers when the Lakers backed out of the contract when it was revealed he is being named in a lawsuit for, what was the term, sexual misconduct? I guess a woman is claiming he gave her an STD.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You can't unsee that on Twitter, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that came across Twitter earlier this week, so That was the ugly. I hate that for Jamil. I hope maybe it's some kind of misunderstanding or frivolous. Whatever it is, I hope he is able to move past it and get to playing basketball again, because that is just unfortunate timing that that lawsuit pops up at a time when he was looking for work and was very close to signing what may have been a full NBA deal with or I think it was going to be a 10-day contract. So if you maybe get two 10-day contracts, then you can get a full-time deal. But, yeah, I hated that for Jamil. I don't know what the truth is or whatever happened there, but whatever it is, I hope the best for Jamil. I hope it all gets worked out one way or the other and that he can get back to playing basketball. But so, yeah, that's my good, bad, and the ugly for this week, Marquette in the NBA. Good for Dwight, bad for Vander, and ugly for Jamil.
Holy crow. Well, you not to make light of that kind of thing, but it's poor timing on the lawsuit, too. If he was about to get a contract, you might not want to wait for that to come in.
Exactly. Like I said, if that thing had popped up a couple weeks from now, when he's maybe signed maybe a second 10-day contract with the Lakers, then maybe it wouldn't have been as big a deal. Maybe it's like, hey, man, just go handle your stuff, and you know, we'll be here for you when you get back. But the fact that he was a free agent and the Lakers said, we're just going to go somewhere else with this. Sorry about good luck with all that. So hated that for Jamil. So hated to end the podcast on a down note, I guess. But it's just kind of an interesting week for Marquette guys in the NBA. Hey, one of positive note, Jimmy Butler is in the MVP conversation. So there's that.
I think and he's got music videos coming out starring him, and it's all nuts.
Jimmy Butler, what a career he's had.
JFB.
In the NBA. Yeah, talk about a guy who has exceeded expectations since college. I mean, I thought he would be a nice role player in the NBA, but the fact that, I mean, there was an article this week saying, should Jimmy Butler be in the MVP conversation, considering how he's kind of transformed the Timberwolves? He's got our vote, for what it's worth. An all-time fan favorite at Marquette, really, and what he's doing in the NBA is just incredible. So that's maybe a double shot of good as far as Marquette in the NBA. So good for Jimmy Butler.
Well, and I really enjoyed Jimmy Butler guarding Dwayne Wade in their recent game. And Jimmy got the better of Dwayne, so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, Jimmy's maybe at a bit different stage of his career than Dwayne
that's
is
true.
At this point. But, still, I mean, nothing but impressed with every time I watch Jimmy Butler play basketball. I hope it leads to another all-star appearance so Marquette can extend the silly stat that I like to throw out that Marquette has had an all-star every year since 2004 in the NBA. Like to see that streak continued, and I think Jimmy Butler's going to get that streak continued. So, yeah, good for Jimmy.
Yeah, and he's got my all-time favorite former Marquette player gif out there right now. So
yeah, the one where he's on the bench staring.
Like, well, there's like that one, and then there's the one where he's kind of jogging backwards, saying inappropriate things while swiping his chest.
Yeah, that one is also good. They're two very solid Jimmy Butler gifs, whatever you want to call them, out there. So
they're not peanut butter.
However you want to wrap up the podcast, let's do it with that. So, if I could send out a Jimmy Butler gift to you all, that is how I would like to wrap up this podcast. But I would like to also thank you guys all for listening. As always, we appreciate you here on Scrambled Eggs. You can hit us up on Twitter, give us your thoughts, what we said and what we should talk about in the future. I'm Joe McCann, 3 on Twitter. Phil is MOOOF23. Crack Sidewalks is the team handle. You can leave your comments on cracksidewalks.com where we post the podcast. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. And you can also leave your comments on Facebook. We have a Scrambled Eggs Facebook page as well. Phil, final thoughts before we get out of here?
Just beat DePaul.
Beat freaking DePaul. Just beat DePaul. Then we'll all be happy. Seashells and balloons, everyone. Free Matt Helton.